talk about what did Columbus Day truly mean. And when we watched more in depth, we realized that Columbus Day, at the beginning of Columbus Day, was trying to deceive us from the truth and knowing that it's actually a horrible day. I think it's important for us to show up because it's basically showing a way of how that we can spread the truth to others and they won't be deceived at this holiday being so special.
Thanks, everyone.
For me, when I think about this museum, when I look at the statue and when I look at the statue of Columbus or I look at the statue of Dr. J. Marion Sims, I'm thinking of the little black and brown and indigenous kids who are walking around the city, right, who are being told visually over and over again that their lives do not matter. And in 2017, quite frankly, we're not here for it. We've never been here for it. And what we're trying to do here is get people across struggles to stand together, not just this is the statue I want taken down, but these are the statues that we want taken down. And really, for me, it means a lot for our youth. And having them grow up in a place where they can see themselves, accurate representations of themselves, not something like that's represented in the statue that's behind me.
Special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Andre Lewis, Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Renee Felst, and Ian Gesder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Calling Home the Dead on Thursday, October 19th at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Calling Home the Dead is a fundraiser for VOZ and KBOO Community Radio that includes music, dancing, a procession of cachinas y cachinas, and delicious Dia de los Muertos pastries and horchata. The film, Calling Home the Dead, will also be screened, showing the Dia de los Muertos traditions of the towns that surround Lake Pátzcuaro in Mexico. Again, that's Calling Home the Dead on Thursday, October 19th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 5:01 p.m., in just a few moments, you'll be listening to the Tuesday volunteer-produced evening news.
Don't you know it's gonna be? And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KABU Evening News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, the Montevilla Neighborhood Association held its broad elections today and amid sharp political disagreements.
Jay Bishop, who was arrested on Sunday for bringing a weapon and ammo to a right-wing rally on federal property downtown, has been released.
And an asteroid the size of a house will pass between the Earth and the Moon later this week. Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, October 10th, 2017. I'm Jasmine.
And I'm Kyle. We have a follow-up to yesterday's report on the arrest of Jay Bishop at the Patriot Prayer Rally at Terror Shrunk Plaza on Sunday. Bishop was arrested by officers from the Department of Homeland Security after finding several magazines of ammunition in his backpack and a .22 caliber pistol in the seat of his motorcycle. He was initially charged with being a felon in possession of a firearm and carrying a concealed weapon, but yesterday prosecutors dropped all charges, arguing that because the gun was discovered in a locked compartment of his motorcycle, it was likely the result of an illegal search. The Oregonian quotes first assistant to the Multnomah County District Attorney, Jeffrey Howells, as saying, quote, "After receiving the reports, we feel the search that revealed the weapon would fail to withstand a motion to suppress in state court," unquote. Howells went on to say that the case would be referred back to federal officers and prosecutors.
Micah Fletcher, who as many may remember is the survivor of the MAX train stabbing last May, has won a seat on the board of the Montevilla Neighborhood Association. Fletcher plans to work to make the neighborhood safer by implementing an anti-racist neighborhood watch. He also plans on working for real solutions to the area's homeless problem. There has been a sharp division among neighborhood association members as of late, with one group led by board chair calling themselves Portland Assembly, who say they are anti-fascists and anti-police state. The other group, which calls themselves Montevilla Initiative, have a more right-leaning agenda on taking back Montevilla. As of late, the two groups have made accusations at each other. The Assembly have said that their personal lives have been dug into, and Initiative members have shown up at their houses. While Initiative members have made complaints that Assembly members have tried to tie them to alt-right leader Joey Gibson. Gibson himself had said at a downtown rally last Sunday that he would be attending Monday night's Neighborhood Association meeting. However, on a Monday Facebook post, he said he would not be going.
A state of emergency has been declared in 8 Northern California counties as multiple wildfires rip through the region, forcing mandatory evacuations, reducing entire neighborhoods to ash, and claiming the lives of at least 15 people. Overall, 20,000 people have been forced to evacuate. 1,500 homes have been lost, and 115,000 acres burned. At least 150 people are reported missing. The first of the fires started on Sunday night and spread quickly, fanned by strong winds and dry conditions. The largest fire, the Tubbs Fire, has burned 27,000 acres in and around the city of Santa Rosa in Sonoma County, where the residents had about 20 minutes to pack up their belongings and flee, with some forced to leave on foot. Two more large fires, the Atlas Fire and the Redwood Complex Fire, have burned a combined 44,000 acres and caused significant destruction to homes, infrastructure, and the region's famous vineyards. None of the fires are contained at this time.
Last March, the United States Census gave its required list of proposed topics to Congress for its 2020 Survey of America. At the very end of the 77-page report was a new item, a proposal on sexual orientation and gender identity. Not long after the Bureau had released its proposal, a newer version was made public, but this time the line about sexual orientation and gender identity was missing. The United States Census did not initially post an update about what had changed to its website or explain the change in depth. The modifications to the proposal to include more inclusive questions on identity in upcoming surveys just appeared. Advocates and allies of the LGBTIA+ community were outraged. The National LGBTQ Task Force began circulating a graphic claiming, quote, "We've been erased," and Chelsea Clinton tweeted a link to an article in Out Magazine decrying the change, saying, "Trump administration omits LGBTQ people from 2020 census." The United States Census has never included questions about gender and sexual orientation before, and in a statement, the director of the Bureau, John Thompson, gave more clarification on sexual orientation and gender identity, saying that they were never meant to be included on the proposed list of topics and that, quote, "there was no federal data needed to change the planned census and ACS subjects." While the Bureau is adamant that their decision was a clerical error, LGBTQIA+ advocates insist that this incident is proof that the Trump administration is biased against LGBTQIA+ Americans.
After a strong outcry towards the U.S. Census Bureau in regards to it no longer including the original proposed questions on sexual orientation and gender, members of a working group of the Bureau's National Advisory Committee on Racial, Ethnic, and Other Populations met this fall on a conference call with Bureau staffers about raised concerns on the proposal's change. The U.S. Census considers input, though its census barriers, attitudes, and motivators survey for CBAMS, the survey first marketed in 2008 for the 2010 census. In preparation for the 2020 census, and the Bureau published a Federal Register notice in August to collect public comments on more current draft questionnaire. The public responses, conference feedback, and CBAMS data were collected and a decision released that sexual orientation would remain in the census but gender identity would not.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. National Nurses United in Puerto Rico, with its volunteer RN Emergency Response Network, says that federal relief efforts are glacially slow. The Nurses Union is warning of dire conditions threatening a growing health calamity for millions. They say while they hear boasts of great response, the reality on the ground is far different. That reality includes people who have yet to get any food, water, or other supplies from FEMA or any other agency. People standing in line for hours in blistering heat for water and food only to find federal disaster officials bringing paperwork to collect data instead. A breakout of leptospirosis, a dangerous, deadly bacterial disease. The nurses say the harsh reality is a woefully inadequate government response in Puerto Rico. At least 120 Teamsters are on the ground in Puerto Rico trying to deliver relief supplies, but the Teamsters say it's even worse than it appears in media accounts. Traffic lights out, much of the power still out, very hot conditions. Teamsters General President Jim Hoffa says Teamsters volunteers are working in critical roles of supply delivery, sanitation support, hooking up generators, and debris removal following the devastation wrought by Hurricane Maria. Faculty at the University of Minnesota are shifting tactics in a push for worker power and organization at the university. The Minnesota Court of Appeals ruled in September barring tenured and non-tenured faculty from joining together in solidarity in one union bargaining unit. Minnesota Academics United, affiliated with SEIU Local 284, had filed for the union election back in January of 2016. Instead of appealing that court decision, faculty will instead form a workers' association. In a posted union video, faculty like Marta Shore explained some of the issues driving faculty to want to organize at the University of Minnesota.
In the past 10 years, I have seen class sizes increase and tuition increase. When I was a TA in 2005, our labs were 25 students, so I was responsible for 50 students. I got to know the students. The class I'm teaching this fall has 200 students.
Shared governance of the university is one of the principles at stake as faculty organizes. Christian Karab said one problem in higher ed is market-driven governance without sharing power with faculty.
Everything has to be understood in a business paradigm. That's fundamentally inconsistent with the whole idea of a public research institution.
WIN is America's multimedia news voice for workers.
We need to make more money. You know, what they're paying us, the greedy corporations, they just want to pay us what they want to pay us. And it's not right.
We are sick of an economy and a democracy that are rigged against us.
Support WIN's worker news mission at workersindependentnews.com. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
Water is all over the news this week. For more, we go to This Week in Water from H2O Radio.
Can balloons reconnect Puerto Rico? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
On Sunday morning, Nate, the fastest hurricane ever to cross the Gulf of Mexico, struck Mississippi and Alabama after hitting Louisiana. Luckily, the storm spared New Orleans and rapidly weakened as it moved inland.
Flooding did occur in parts of Mississippi and Alabama, and there were power outages in some areas. But there seemed to be a collective sigh of relief as Hurricane Nate did not pack the destructive force of siblings Harvey, Irma, and Maria.
While the effects of the storms have been horrific for humans, they have also impacted animals. Irma destroyed more than half of the incubating sea turtle nests in a national wildlife refuge on a barrier island off of Florida's east coast.
The area is one of the most important loggerhead and green turtle nesting sites in the world, according to Science Daily.
And researchers are also worried about Monkey Island off the coast of eastern Puerto Rico, inhabited by hundreds of rhesus macaques. And while it appears many survived Hurricane Maria, their food supplies were decimated.
Scientists have studied the monkeys on the island since the 30s when animals were brought there from Southeast Asia. Mother Jones reports that researchers are taking food and water to the island in addition to helping residents of Punta Santiago in Puerto Rico, where many of the staff for Monkey Island live.
It's only been about 6 weeks since Hurricane Harvey stalled over southeast Texas and dumped more than 50 inches of rain in the Houston area. Of course, the effects of the storm are still being felt.
Last week, the EPA confirmed that one of the most powerful carcinogens, dioxin, has leaked from a Superfund site from the San Jacinto River just east of Houston. The agency found the chemical in samples of river sediment.
The contamination comes from a paper mill operated in the 1960s and is just one of the Superfund sites inundated during Harvey. Concentrations of leaked dioxin are 2,000 times higher than the level at which the EPA requires cleanup.
The fact that the site was vulnerable was made clear way before Harvey. The Houston Chronicle reports that 3 years ago, Samuel Brody, a professor at Texas A&M, said the site was a loaded gun that could cause severe contamination if hit by a violent storm or hurricane.
Meanwhile, Jackie Young, who grew up near the area and is a founder of a grassroots organization, told the Chronicle that the scary part of the leak is they have no way of knowing where all the contaminated material was carried by the floodwaters. Fracking cannot and will not take place in Scotland. Those were the words of Paul Wheelhouse, the country's energy minister, as the government banned the controversial practice last week.
The Guardian reports that Wheelhouse said allowing fracking would cause long-lasting negative impacts on communities, damaging public health, the environment, and climate goals.
Scotland's economy depends on natural gas for much of its residential heating and commercial activity, but that was not enough to sway residents whom the government surveyed about the issue through a process called consultation. Almost 100% of 65,000 respondents opposed fracking.
Scottish Conservatives said the decision would discourage much-needed economic investment. The government's ban will be put to a vote in the Scottish Parliament later this year and is expected to pass easily.
On Friday, two earthquakes struck Japan in the same area as the Fukushima nuclear power plant that was destroyed in 2011.
No injuries have been reported and no tsunami occurred, but the danger of earthquakes and their lasting effect on nearby nuclear power plants was highlighted by a recent paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences.
The research shows that the groundwater underneath beaches, 60 miles away, is highly contaminated from the 2011 disaster.
As reported in Science News, the authors of the study theorized that seawater tainted with radioactive material traveled along coastal waters and lapped up against beaches. The radioactive material stuck to the sand and likely percolated down. Now it's making its way back into the ocean.
The research notes that the contaminated groundwater is not currently a public health threat, but about 200 of the world's 440 nuclear power plants are located along coastlines, and as Newsweek reports, if a similar incident happens again, it may not be as benign.
And finally, when Hurricane Maria hit Puerto Rico last month, it not only destroyed access to food and running water, it made communicating about those needs difficult. The FCC said as of last Friday that more than 80% of Puerto Rico's cell towers are still down and only 11% of residents have power.
Companies like Google and Tesla are responding to the crisis. Google's parent company Alphabet was granted an emergency experimental FCC license for its Project Loon to use solar-powered, high-altitude balloons in the hopes of providing mobile phone service.
The balloons are about the size of a tennis court when inflated and carry the equivalent of a cell tower communications package. Although the technology is still new, it had some success in bringing Wi-Fi to Peru when serious floods hit there last January.
How soon the balloons will be operational is still unknown. A company spokesperson said they're working with the island's telecommunications provider to integrate the technology.
Still, if they get cell service, how would people charge their devices? With solar panels, if Tesla's Elon Musk has a say in it, and apparently he does. He and Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, had a 25-minute call last Friday where they discussed relief efforts, with Tesla playing a leading role.
Hundreds of Tesla Powerwall battery systems are already in Puerto Rico, and the company's employees are in the country helping with installation and training. Energy analysts say solar panels linked together in a grid would generate their own power, be less vulnerable to storms, and reduce energy bills.
In an interview with USA Today, Rossello said he's always been interested in renewable energy. He said bringing solar power to the island would be a silver lining to the disaster. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Water quality experts will present the latest science and research in the field at WQTC in Portland, November 12th through 16th. Learn more at awwa.org/WQTC.
And now it's Labor History in Two from our friends at the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1912. That was the day mill workers began to walk off the job at the Phoenix and Gilbert knitting mills in Little Falls, New York. The strike was sandwiched between the Bread and Roses strike in Lawrence, Massachusetts, and the 1913 Patterson textile strike. American, Hungarian, Polish, and Italian workers, over 70% of them women, struck against wage reductions. Their hours had just been cut from 60 hours a week to 54, and their wages adjusted accordingly. A recent Factory Inspection Commission investigation revealed deplorable working and living conditions, among the worst in the state. As a result, state legislators passed protective legislation restricting women's work hours. Many social reformers pushed for laws like these in the hopes of improving women's quality of life by minimizing their exploitation on the job. But the reduction in hours spelled disaster for these mill women, who then faced a loss of income that ranged between 75 cents and $2 a week. Socialists in nearby Schenectady, including the socialist mayor George Lund, arrived in town and were promptly arrested for giving open-air speeches in support of the strikers. IWW organizers soon followed to help organize picketing, daily strike parades, and strike committees for each of the factories. They quickly established IWW Local 801, the National Industrial Union of Textile Workers. By the end of the month, mounted police closed in on the women strikers and began clubbing them, many into unconsciousness. The police raided strike headquarters and arrested IWW strike committee leaders. But the women strikers stood strong and were celebrating victory by the end of the year. They won full reinstatement and 60 hours pay for 54 hours work. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
A house-sized asteroid will give Earth a near miss on Thursday, giving experts a rare chance to rehearse for a real-life strike threat as it passes inside our moon's orbit. This asteroid, now named 2012 TC4, will pass within 44,000 kilometers, which is just above the altitude that many geosynchronous satellites orbit Earth. NASA's Mike Kelly says that there is, quote, no danger, not even for the satellites, unquote. 2012 TC4 is about 15 to 30 meters wide, which is very similar to the asteroid that exploded in the atmosphere over Chelyabinsk in central Russia in 2013. According to Rudiger Jen of the European Science Agency's Near Earth Object Program, the TC4 asteroid will return in its loop around the Sun to Earth in 2015 and again in 2079. He says that, quote, we know today that it will also not hit the Earth in the year 2050, but the close flyby in 2050 might deflect the asteroid such that it could hit the Earth in the year 2079, end quote. According to The Guardian, TC4 is ranked number 13 in the risk list, with 1 in 750 chance of hitting Earth in 2079.
Many people have lost access to desperately needed health care in post-Hurricane Puerto Rico these last few weeks. Harry Figueroa was a teacher who went a week without oxygen that helped him breathe before dying just last week at age 58. Jose L. Cruz's treatment hours have been cut back to save fuel for the generators that power the hospital. The government's announcements each morning attempt to maintain a happy and upbeat tone, but there are many hidden emergencies. Seriously ill patients across Puerto Rico, much like the ones previously mentioned, have had their treatment hours cut by nearly 25% because many centers lack sufficient supply of diesel to run their generators. Less than half of Puerto Rico's medical workforce has reported to work, and even the military and other assistance is not keeping up very well, which includes the Comfort, a ship that was supposed to house many seriously ill Puerto Rico residents.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview for Stand Together Under One Roof. At 6 is Preference, a queer experiment in radio featuring discussions with educator, activist, and author Toby Hill Meyer and author Gabby Rivera. Then at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather will have a low of 41 with a 70% chance of rain. Tomorrow will be colder with a high of 53 and an 80% chance of rain and possible thunderstorms. Today in history... In 732, an army under Charles Martel defeated the invading forces of the Umayyad Caliphate at the Battle of Tours in western France, halting Muslim expansion into Western Europe. Also, in the year 1582, there was also no such thing as October 10th in the countries of Italy, Poland, Portugal, and Spain due to the implementation of the Gregorian calendar. Today is also the birthday of Ed Wood, one of the least acclaimed filmmakers of all time, whose movie Plan 9 from Outer Space gives us our quote of the day: "We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives."
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture from Native Voice One. For more stories and podcasts, find more stories and podcasts at nv1.org.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Supreme Court of Canada has ruled that the records detailing the abuse of former Indian residential school survivors can eventually be destroyed. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the issue had set the privacy of individuals against preserving historical records.
Canada's highest court ruled in a unanimous decision that former residential school students will have 15 years to decide if they want to keep their personal stories preserved. The move puts the decision in the hands of those survivors, not government archivists. The court ruling means that the survivors have a right to keep the records private and have them destroyed. Phil Fontaine was at the forefront of the case. He's also a former national chief of the Assembly of First Nations. Fontaine says the ruling was a good one.
It was... A very clear statement on the rights of survivors, their consent. It is about their dignity. It is about their respect. And we're not gloating in any by any stretch. We're just very thankful that the Supreme Court of Canada came down on the right side in this case.
Native leaders had argued that not to uphold the rights of residential school survivors would be another breach of trust, in the same way that vulnerable people were abused at the schools when they were children. The government had argued that the records should be preserved to ensure what happened will never be forgotten. For more than 100 years, from the late 1880s, tens of thousands of Indigenous children were forced to attend the residential schools funded by the government and run by churches. Thousands were abused. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In southeast Alaska, an early Tlingit village site listed in the National Register of Historic Places may be returned to its descendants. About 52 acres on Indian Point, owned by the city of Juneau, may be transferred to the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Jacob Resnick reports.
At the southernmost point of Auk Cape, a rocky outcropping offers sweeping views of Indian Cove and Indian Island. These names give away this area's history.
This is a south-facing waterfront lot with beautiful views of Auk Bay, which is the exact reason that the native people selected it for their village site so many centuries ago.
Greg Cheney is a lands manager for the city and borough of Juneau. The Cape southern tip has been city-owned since the 1960s.
It's very much like finding a wallet that somebody has. You pick it up on the street and you realize, oh, this belongs to somebody. And so then, you know, I think most people would agree the proper thing to do is to return it to the rightful owners.
A former Juneau assemblyman wrote to the assembly last month recommending that the city give Indian Point to the Gold Belt Heritage Foundation. Randy Wanamaker penned that letter.
We used to put branches in the water for the herring eggs and dip nets in the water and get the herring out. You know, so that was a practice that was going on for thousands of years.
Greg Cheney, the city lands manager, notes this is prime waterfront property, some of the most valuable holdings in the city's portfolio.
So that's why we have to be very careful about transferring it to an organization that's going to look out for the cultural interests of the Auk Quan and not, just look at it as a multi-million dollar asset.
In Auk Bay, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Students at the University of New Mexico were among those celebrating Indigenous Peoples Day Monday and raising awareness about Native issues. April Chi is president of the Kiva Club, a chartered Native student group on campus.
One of the biggest things is fracking and oil and protecting our sacred lands and protecting our sacred sites from outside big oil companies. Also, violence against women, that's something that we really are focusing on this semester as well.
Chi and other Kiva Club members say they're also advocating for university administration to enact the Indigenous Peoples Day holiday on campus. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
After the tragedy in Las Vegas, the subject of gun control has yet again been in the spotlight. KBOO's Al Khan has some thoughts on the subject.
According to the Second Amendment of the Constitution of the United States, a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Where are all the well-regulated militias? I don't see one in Oregon or in any other state. The NRA seems to hide behind the second part of the amendment and disregard the first. You can't have it both ways. I don't want to take all guns away from everyone. Avid hunters who eat what they kill, it's probably better than the meat they get at the grocery store, without the added hormones and whatever else is added to the meat nowadays. So have your favorite deer rifle and your shotgun for birds. I'm fine with that. I have a friend who likes guns, and I asked him the other night, why would anyone ever want a gun that can fire 100 bullets as fast as you can pull the trigger? His answer was, because it's fun. Yes, guns are fun. I personally learned to shoot at a young age, and I've been around guns all my life. I was taught gun safety and to respect a firearm, so I know firsthand that shooting is fun. There are many other things that are fun. Fast cars are fun. Motorcycles are fun. Amusement parks are fun. And music concerts are fun, until someone starts shooting into the crowd from a hotel window, killing 59 people and wounding over 500 more. How could this happen, we ask yet again? How can one man inflict so much carnage in so little time? And why does it happen over and over again? How is the Vegas shooter able to inflict so much damage in so little time? One reason, he used a simple device called a bump stock that lets the weapon's recoil enable rapid fire close to that of a fully automatic weapon. These devices do not change the actual mechanics of the gun and so are legal. But seeing the results, I believe they need to be banned. The fire rate of a semi-automatic weapon alone is enough to cause dramatic carnage, as was seen a little over a year ago in Orlando, Florida. How else did this shooter carry out this outrageous massacre? He was able to purchase thousands of rounds of ammunition and multiple semi-automatic weapons without anyone so much as batting an eye. What is even more disturbing is that these weapons can have the capacity to have multi-round clips. Some of these can hold hundreds of rounds. On eBay, a person can purchase what is called a twin drum magazine that holds 1,200 rounds of ammunition for under $100. This is so far from necessary. There have been over 170 mass shootings in this country so far this year. Many didn't even make national news. Yet when the subject of gun control is approached to Congress, the answer is always, now is not the time. So I ask, when will be the time? How many lives need to be cut short? How many families will lose somebody dearly loved? I've never been a fan of Ronald Reagan. However, in 1989, he said, "I do not believe in taking away the right of the citizen for sporting or hunting and so forth, or for home defense. But I do believe an AK-47, a machine gun, is not a sporting weapon or needed for defense of a home." This I can agree with. There is absolutely no reason for anyone outside of the military to possess a weapon that can fire as fast as you can pull the trigger and have magazines of hundreds of rounds of ammunition. Now, I know the argument. Criminals will get these anyway, so they will have them, and responsible people will have no way to fight back. I find this ridiculous. When the manufacture of semiautomatic weapons and large-capacity magazines is banned, there won't be any to get hold of. And the ones that are already been made? Yes, they will still be out there, for a time. Eventually, the people who have them will be caught and the weapons seized. I'm not saying this will happen overnight, but it is certainly better than doing nothing and watching more people die. All because guns are fun. I'm Al Kahn, and I thank you for your attention.
To be or not to be. Hamlet's immortal question is less and less rhetorical by the year, thanks to the accelerating effects of climate change. On today's Climate Connections, we'll hear about how some folks are starting conversations about climate through theater. Climate Connections is a production of the Yale Center for Environmental Communication.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. This fall, people are performing short plays about climate change in theaters, classrooms, and even living rooms around the world. It's all part of an initiative called Climate Change Theater Action.
Sometimes the science can be intimidating and the politics can be divisive. So it's a way to have a conversation that is more human-based and based in personal experiences and emotions rather than ideologies.
That's Chantal Bilodeau, Artistic Director of the Arctic Cycle, the group behind the global event. She says anybody can volunteer to present a play at a location of their choosing. Participants must select at least one short script from the theater's collection.
They can add poems, dance, songs.
People are also asked to include an action, anything from signing a petition to having a scientist talk about global warming. The performances may take place in intimate venues, but they're live-streamed when possible to reach larger audiences. This year, Climate Change Theater Action started in early October and runs through the UN Climate Talks in November, giving these local performances a global significance. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Last Thursday, Portland City Commissioner Chloe Udaly stood with hundreds of fans and friends of legendary Portland band Dead Moon to issue an emotional city proclamation. KBOO reporter and evening news anchor Jasmine Moneymaker was there and has this report.
Portland punk rockers of all ages gathered in the portico outside City Hall on Thursday to hear City Commissioner Chloe Udaly read a proclamation declaring October 5th, 2017 to be Dead Moon Night. For those of you who might hear the name Dead Moon and have no idea what I'm talking about, I'll let Commissioner Udaly explain.
So I don't know if everyone realizes this, but with the power vested in me, I'm about to make an official proclamation. Yeah. I'm going to look at Fred and Tootie now. They're in their thrones right over there, sir. Okay. Whereas, in 1966, Fred Cole and his band, The Weeds, unexpectedly landed in Portland, Oregon, where at a coffee house called The Folk Singer on Southwest 13th Avenue, he spotted a young Tootie Connor from the corner of his eye, and Tootie later heard Fred's haunting vocals from the Midtown Ballroom stage. 2 decades later, the couple would meet the charming Andrew Loomis at Rock Club Satyricon on Northwest 6th Avenue, and the trio were destined to form the band they'd called Dead Moon in 1987. And whereas Dead Moon was woven into the fabric of the city and its community, Fred and Tootie selling sticks and strings at their Deacon Building music shop and hangout. Captain Whiz Eagle starting band after band with Portland musicians, the two sharing rock and roll war stories while raising their three kids. Meanwhile, Andrew was a well-known fixture. Actually, I think the last time I saw Andrew was sitting at the bar in Satyricon, so well-known fixture around town at places like Satyricon and EJ's. Dead Moon even cut their vinyl masters on the same lathe that cut the Kingsmen's Louie Louie at Portland's Northwestern Recording Studio, pioneers of a fiercely independent, do-it-yourself spirit. And whereas Dead Moon has been an economic force helping sustain, inspire, and grow Portland's music scene, its record stores, music shops, its poster artists and sound engineers, the hardworking bartenders slinging drinks at clubs, the people booking bands, the countless musicians sharing a stage, and the fans coming from down the street and across the globe to support Portland music, build its business ecosystem, and foster a one-of-a-kind camaraderie and supportive home. And whereas Dead Moon is more than just a band, it is a whole greater than the sum of its parts, an ethos and identity for an international tribe, many emblazoned with the same iconic skull and moon. Do we have any skull and moon tattoos here tonight?
Fred has one.
Fred definitely has one, I think. Some of that tribe are still with us, some only in spirit of a pre-show huddle. The band and the unwavering candle flicker of its wax-laden Jack Daniels bottle is a beacon to the DIY underdog. Dead Moon truly are musical ambassadors of Portland. Now, therefore, I, Chloe Daly, Portland City Commissioner, on behalf of Ted Wheeler, Mayor of the City of Portland, Oregon, the City of Roses, do hereby proclaim October 5th, 2017, to be Dead Moon Night. Residents of our fine city to observe this night, however they see fit. So,
let's party!
And party we did. For the next hour and a half, we were treated to 13 songs by 13 bands. Bands made up of prominent figures from Portland's music scene. People like Chris Newman of Napalm Beach, Jerry A. and Charlie Nims of Poison Idea, Sam Henry of the Wipers, Sean Krogan of Cracker Bash, Michael Hurley, Marissa Anderson, Ural Thomas, Aaron Yankee, Sam Kuntz, Sarah Lunt, and many more. Too many to name. And everyone who played took a moment to thank Fred and Tootie for the support that they had given them, for the inspiration, for the space, for the resources, for the guitars, for everything. For those of us who miss being in the crowd at a Dead Moon show, who miss the sense of energy and community and belonging that we found there, it truly was a memorable night. And also one that made all of us, I think, a little bit homesick for a time that's past, for people who are gone, and for a city that's changing every day, and sometimes to the point where it's almost unrecognizable. So I'll play a song for you that picks me up whenever I'm feeling down. It's Okay by Dead Moon. Thanks, Fred, Tootie, and Andrew, wherever you are. We love you.
Seen better days. It's okay. You don't have to run and hide away. It's okay. It's okay. Yeah, we love you anyway. All those reckless moments when doubt is creeping in your head. Feeling like you lost your youth in the dreams you had, cold and dead. I can't reach you anymore.
It's gonna take a different man. I can't protect you like before. Just lift me on my hand. But it's okay.
It's okay.
We all seen better days. It's okay.
It's okay.
You don't have to run and hide away. It's okay. I wish that I could light the path that leads to a life of no mistakes. Hold you from the done, be done, the living out of safety seems to take. I remember still the child in you, as if only yesterday. It was easy to break through, only had to kiss the pain. And it's okay.
Hey, it's okay.
We all seen better days.
Chance, this is my life, my opening hour. This is my choice, this is my voice. There may be no tomorrow. This is my plea, this is my need. It's my time for standing free. This is my step, this is my death. In a world demanded of me, it's okay.
And that was Jasmine Moneymaker reporting for KBOO.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Isabel Cochran, Al Kahn, Jasmine Moneymaker, and Sam Bowman. The producer is Zelos Marchant. Our engineer is Wesley the Potentiometer Seway. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Jasmine Moneymaker.
And I'm Kyle Carrezzi. Coming up tomorrow on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Wednesday Talk Radio, Paul Rowland welcomes your calls. At 9, it's Political Perspectives. Host Linda Olsen Osterlin welcomes Carl Dix to discuss the upcoming widespread and ongoing street protests of the Trump regime that will begin November 4th across the country. Call in and add your voice. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Dirtbag hosts a discussion of chippers, pineapple guava, and the Home Orchard Society's All About Fruit Show. KBOO keeps you informed and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Good evening, I'm Kyle Carrezzi with the Evening News and In Depth. Stand Together Under One Roof is an event that is bringing together groups and individuals working for racial, social, and environmental justice. The event hosts speakers, music, panels, sessions, displays, conversation, and community building designed to facilitate a presentation and sharing of projects and purposes and stories. The event is on Saturday, October 14th at the Rose City Park Presbyterian Church. And with me I have Bonnie McKinley. Welcome to the studio.
Welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. So What is Stand Together Under One Roof?
Stand Together Under One Roof is a day where people can come to a church. It is not a church. There will be no church service at all. But a church has been given to us by the generous Rose City Park Presbyterian Church, and they pretty much just let us have the space. And they wanted us to have it. We requested it to bring folks from the community in for other folks in the community to have an understanding of what's going on in the Portland and beyond activist community.
And what's your involvement with the event?
Well, I'm one of the organizers. There's mm-hmm. a team of us that have been working on it for quite some time. And we have finally run into our deadline, and our day is coming up, and we hope to invite as many people as possible to come to join us.
That's very nice. And what's the schedule for the day?
The schedule is the doors open at 9, and at that time we'll have at least 35 tables set up from various organizations. For example, we'll have Civil Liberties Defense Center, KABU Radio, Friends mm-hmm. of the Columbia Gorge, VOS Workers' Rights Education Project, Millennio, NAACP Portland Branch, 1120, Street Roots, and numbers of organizations will be tabling. And after the table, well, the tables will go on till 3:30. That's ongoing throughout the day. But then we'll have a panel, and the topic of the panel is our community, understanding and collaborations. And we have a pretty impressive panel, I feel. We have two youth activists. We have Francisco Aguirre from the immigration rights community, and we have Loretta Guzman from the Bison Coffee House, very important community feature in the Cully neighborhood. We have Soren Impey from Portland Tenants United, and we have Ibrahim Mubarak from Right to Survive. The two youths are active in, we have Kalandra Anderson, who is an active clean air activist, and Ella Schreiner, who's done a lot for fossil fuels, and she's to stop fossil fuels, and she testifies and works on video and stuff like that.
And what do you and the rest of the organizers hope an attendee will take away from the event?
Well, you know, so many of us, for myself, for example, I'm pretty focused day to day on climate. And I think it's really important that there's more unity between the activist groups. I want to know more about the other issue-focused organizations, and I think that it's important for all of us. We need as much unity as we can in our community and well beyond. So we hope that people get a glimpse of these other organizations, and we hope that people reach out beyond their own personal issue interest, or at least other organizations on that issue. But we really hope that if, for example, you're very active, as I have been, on climate, people gain familiarity on housing issues, immigration, racial equity issues, et cetera. So I think we really need to connect. And one of the best ways of connecting is by our awareness of these people. You know, we are so often at rallies together, actions together. Well, we all come out for so many different issues at City Hall, wherever, that we all care about, but we don't always know the day-to-day work of these organizations. And we want to have the people come together. After the panel, we'll have 4 20-minute sessions where organizations can present what they do, their interesting stories, the work that they're taking on, and their hopes for the future.
And what do you think the best way is for a person to experience the event, meeting everyone and getting to know all these organizations?
Well, I think extending yourself beyond your own issue is really important. Visiting the tables, we'll have between the two session periods, between session one and session two, we'll have hip hop from Freddie Flopez, and there'll be some food and more time to go to the tables and just step right up to those tables and see what people have there and connect and ask questions, because that's what they want. And then after that break session, we'll have 2 more sessions where people can choose where to go. And we have a pretty extensive printed program for people that they can take away. Obviously, people are only getting exposed to the panelists and four of the sessions that they select, and we have 28 ongoing sessions, so they have to choose fast. But we are giving everyone a big broadside that will describe the organizations and how to connect, and of course the tabling. So after the sessions are over, we'll have about 50-minute closing with more music. We will have Francisco Aguirre again, this time playing guitar, and we'll have Songs and Soldiers Voices singing a group song. We'll have from Portland's Resistance a keynote from Gregory McKelvey, and then last crack at the tables and more hip-hop, this time with Quincy Davis.
And how much is the event going to be, anything?
Oh, it's totally free. Everything's free. Nice. Free childcare, free snacks, free treats, free coffee. Yeah, it's all free. We wouldn't consider doing it any other way. If people feel like making a donation to some of our printing costs or the cost for our site manager from the church, that's fine. But there's absolutely no pressure. Nothing. There's no sliding scale or anything. Just come on in. That's what we want. People there packing the church on Saturday, October 14th.
And you mentioned childcare. What kind of services in that regard would be provided for people?
Well, we have a full childcare staff that will be there, and there'll be art. And I know there's a guitar that seems to go in place there. So. Mm-hmm. People can call me to reserve childcare or show up. If we know in advance, it's helpful. I can be reached at 503-705-1943. Or you could contact me via email, and that's go2350pdx@gmail.com to reserve childcare or to answer any questions that you might have about the event.
And I guess as we start to wrap up, we'll mention again that the event is on Saturday, October 14th, and it's at the Rose City Park Presbyterian Church. And is there anything you want to add?
Well, I'd like to tell you where the Rose City Park Presbyterian Church is. It's right off Sandy at between 44th and 45th. The entrance is at 44th. So it's right next, right across the street from the Hollywood Farmers Market. Really easy to find. There's a lot of good transit there. If you want to get in really early and you are in a car, you might want to come a little extra early to find parking because of the farmers market. But we really hope people come. The best way to build our community is to understand our community and know about it.
And that stand together under one roof. So Bonnie, yeah, thanks for coming by the station.
Thank you, Kabu.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater in Portland. Radiance of Resistance is an award-winning documentary that tells the story of two youths who have become global ambassadors for Palestinian human rights. The film is an intimate look at their everyday lives and roles as part of a new generation of Palestinian civil rights leaders. Again, that's Radiance of Resistance, Thursday, October 12th at 6 p.m. at McMiniman's Mission Theater, 1624 Northwest Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.